Spring is here, and many people are probably starting to think about vacation plans. For some, the beach or the theme park are oh so last year. These days, many people are interested in roughing it, swimming with the whales, getting close to the butterflies, or running with the bison in sub-zero temperatures. We learned all about it in this week's Washington Post magazine, a place we visit just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. Visiting us to talk about this week's travel issue is Tom Schroeder, editor of the magazine. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me.
On the one hand, this seems very new, you know, the kinds of travel you described. On the other hand, Americans have always sort of yearned for nature. You know, I think about, you know, Teddy Roosevelt and so forth. So what do you think distinguishes this kind of travel experience that people are pursuing?
Well, I think in general, with our philosophy for travel stories is it's not just something that you passively enjoy. It's something that you enter into. It's a journey. It's something that changes you by the time you leave. And that's what we look for in travel stories in general. And I don't think there's anything that does that as sort of intensely as encounters with nature and with the wildness of the world. And that's why we put together these particular stories this week.
Tell us about the three destinations you described in the magazine,
well,
briefly.
Yeah,
because obviously that's why there's a whole issue, because there's a lot to say.
But one of them, you know, is you go out on a ship and you go into a territory where it's a reserve where whales are encountered frequently. And you actually go out and put on a mask and a snorkel. No scuba diving is permitted. And you get real close to these unbelievably beautiful animals. Another one is the annual migration of monarch butterflies to Mexico, where millions and millions of butterflies return to the place where they were born. And very often, I don't know how they know this actually, but very often they come to the very same tree in the forest in Mexico where they were born to spawn some more. And it's an incredibly beautiful and moving experience, and the story is about the impact it has on the people who come to watch it. And then the third story is watching buffalo in Yellowstone Park, and it's a gorgeous wintry landscape at the time that our writer went there. And it wasn't just the buffalo. I mean, he saw all sorts of elk and even wolves, which really came home to me because I had a personal experience with that, which I'll tell you about.
Yeah, I heard you wrote about that. So why don't you tell us about the experience, which apparently nobody believes you.
Right, right. This
all
was
the
in,
more reason to write about it. It's
in the 1970s, and a friend and I went to Yellowstone, but the gate was closed when we got there. It was May, but it was snowed in. So we just went down the road a little bit to a roadside park, and we started climbing up a hill there. And it was, you know, fairly warm. So we were climbing in like jeans and sneakers. But as we climbed up higher in the hill, there started to be patches of snow. And then we saw this elk kill, and it looked like atomized elk. Something big had gotten this thing. So we got a little bit worried, but it looked old, so we kept going. And then the snow started getting deeper and deeper, and as we crested up the hill, we were like thigh deep in snow, and from behind this tree emerged this big, huge wolf, and it ran across right in front of us, maybe 20 feet in front of us, and it scampered up a hill. And later, when we told people about it, they didn't believe us because they said, there haven't been wolves in Yellowstone for 30 years. And sure enough, every time I looked it up, after then, they said the same thing. They had been eradicated. And so I just didn't know what to make of this. And the writer of the Yellowstone story was gently trying to tell me, well, I think you saw a big coyote. But I'm telling you, coyotes are 45 pounds. I have a dog that's 45 pounds. This dog was like 2.5 times the size of my dog.
So this whole issue arose because you had to prove that you actually saw this wolf.
Right.
Is that what happened?
Yes.
But I did want to ask, though, that there are those many of the people who have these journeys, this takes on a spiritual dimension. I mean, it is truly life-changing. Some people worry that this is changing the environment, that these kinds of trips kind of destroy the very thing that people go to see. And I just wonder if you talk about that at all
magazine. They definitely talk about you have to do this responsibly, and there's always a balance that you have to achieve. But I think that, you know, our responsibility is really to try to be aware of that issue. I don't think there's ever going to be a perfect solution because anytime a human comes into an environment, it has some impact. And even when we don't physically go into the environment, we're having a huge impact by everything that we do. So it's just something that you really have to be sensitive to. But there's nothing like the passion for the wild world that you get from personally experiencing it to make people motivated to make sacrifices to preserve it. And I think that that's, in the end, that that's the value of this.
One of the things that was fascinating about the pieces is that for some people, people were drawn to these experiences because they had had something life-changing. Like one person was drawn to the monarch butterfly rebirth or whatever, because she had mastered a terrible illness, and she promised herself that if she survived that, she was going to go and see the world. On the other hand, as you pointed out, many of the people who conduct these tours do so out of such a passion for the environment and for those the places that they're trying to preserve. So it's just a very interesting balance.
Yes,
and I thought that the
pieces, I think there's a real feeling among among some people that the possibility for renewal of all sorts in the world comes from the wildness of the world and not the human-dominated portion of it.
Tom Schroeder is the editor of the Washington Post magazine. He was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington. If you want to read these pieces in their entirety and see the beautiful photography that accompanies the articles, you can find a link on our website, npr.org/tellmemore. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Shift gears now to bring you up to date on another story we've been following about the changes in federal sentencing guidelines. Hundreds of people in prison on federal crack cocaine charges became eligible for early release earlier this month. Some are now free. Previously, we heard from Natasha Marshall. She's a California mother who was released from prison 3 years early. And we also spoke with Wayne Ickard. He's a North Carolina minister who testified against the changes leading to the early release because he blames crack on the devastation of his community. Here with us now for another Behind Closed Doors conversation is Julie Stewart. She's president of Families Against Mandatory Minimums. She's here with me in the studio. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Given the scope of what's happened since the new regulations went into effect, how many people are actually affected by this? I mean, this has been such an attention-getting story for people who follow these things. But how many people are really affected by it?
Well, I guess you could say on the one hand, not very many. On the other hand, those who are affected are very happy by it. I got statistics for this program actually on Friday, and since March 3rd, when this became effective, so far almost 2,300 people have been resentenced. And of those 2,300, just over 1,000 have actually been released early.
Now, these are all federal offenders. Isn't it true that most people who've been sentenced for crack cocaine violations are in state prisons through the state system? Isn't that correct? So how many people is that?
Well, there are hundreds of thousands of people in state prison, rather, unfortunately. And that's where the bulk of the prisoners go. The federal prison system only has 200,000 people in it. I mean, that's a lot. But nationwide, we have over 2 million people in prisons. So most of the people in prison in this country are in the state system.
Are you hearing from families who believe these changes, these sentencing changes, may affect them? And are you having to tell them that actually they don't?
We did a lot of pre-planning and helping people understand who would be able to apply and who wouldn't, and we encouraged them to talk to their lawyers. So I think people had a pretty good idea when March 3rd rolled around who would and wouldn't be able to benefit from this. But we've heard from a good number of people who are just thanking us repeatedly for helping make this change happen. And it's funny because last spring when we were talking about this modest change, as the U.S. Sentencing Commission called it, to the crack cocaine guidelines, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, should we even support it? Is it big enough? And of course, we felt like we had to be pragmatic and take what we could get. And so we did support it. And now it seems like it's, you know, the best thing since sliced bread. Well, you know, it is still a modest change. It did not change the mandatory minimum sentences. It only changed the sentencing guidelines. That's a bit complicated. But people who are sitting on 5- and 10-year mandatory sentences do not benefit from this.
Talk to me, before we get to your point of view on this, I wanted to play you something that we heard from Wade Eckhart. He's a minister in South Statesville, North Carolina. He heads a program called Weed and Seed. I'm sure you know about it. It's an anti-drug program sponsored by the Department of Justice. He was responding to an earlier conversation that we had with Natasha Marshall, who had been released 3 years early. He actually testified against changing the sentencing guidelines. Here's what he had to say.
The community has lost. A lot of the businesses have gone. The crime rate has just skyrocketed. The gangs are so territorial now that we have constantly murders and robberies. The dropouts in school now, it has just increased tremendously because, once again, crack being the poor man's drug, as they say it is, it's a quick way to make money. So now, why work?
So clearly, everybody doesn't think it's the best thing since sliced bread. There are those who think that this is terrible and that this is the kind of thing that sends the wrong message, that people are not going to be held accountable fully for the devastation that they have caused to their communities. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that it's a bit of a red herring. This is a very modest change. It affects, as I say, maybe they estimated 1,600 people would be released, you know, within the first year, up to 2,600 people across the country. So it's not going to be 19,500 people coming back into one community at one time. I think that crack cocaine was very devastating in the 80s. To a lot of communities. Some of those communities have not fully recovered from that, but I would be loath to say that crack defendants or crack offenders are the reason that communities now are not recovering. I think that there's a lot of very complicated socioeconomic reasons that communities are not recovering.
Part of the reason that you got involved in this issue said you had a family member who was incarcerated on a drug-related offense, was caught up in the whole mandatory minimums thing. Is it personally painful for you to hear the resistance that some people have to what is to you a very common sense approach toward equalizing what a lot of people have seen as a kind of a gross inequality and just a really sort of an excessive punishment for crimes that the people who are affected by this are nonviolent offenders, they're first-time offenders and so forth. Does that bother you?
I think after almost 17 or 18 years of doing this, I've finally gotten used to the fact that not everyone agrees with me. But I think that people also need to look beyond their immediate knee-jerk reaction when they hear the word drugs, crack, crime, and be a little more thoughtful about how we can increase public safety efficiently and smartly and responsibly. And certainly incarcerating for 10 or 15 or 20 years people who have admittedly broken the law, and we have no problem with them being punished, but let the punishment fit the crime. I think it's a fundamental tenet that Americans actually believe that the punishment should fit the crime and the individual's role in the crime. And most of the mandatory sentences we have today simply don't allow judges to do that.
I'd like to hear more about that. Why do you think the punishment doesn't fit the crime? Why do you think that the system is so out of whack?
Well, what we hear all the time from judges is that they are forced to give these sentences. My hands are tied. I don't want to do this, but the law requires me to. How we got there, I think, is a matter of going all the way back to Len Bias's death in the 1980s. And, you know, that Congress responded by saying, well, we'll fix this problem. We'll create these stiff mandatory sentences, and that will deter people from getting involved in drug crime. Deterrence is a wonderful theory, but it's not the most realistic one. It may deter a small percentage of people. But as the minister said, in fact, drugs are a lucrative business to be in. And as long as there's a market for it, there will be a supply. So I think that we just have to be much more creative about how we deal with this problem.
Did you mind telling us a little bit about your brother, who was the reason that you got in this area to begin with, and how he's doing now?
No, he's doing great. But he was 35 years old. He was growing marijuana with two other men in a garage in Spokane, Washington. They were all arrested. Actually, the two men who were living in the house showed the garage full of marijuana plants to a neighbor, and the neighbor turned them in. They in turn turned my brother in, and so he ended up going to prison for 5 years for growing marijuana. There's no parole in the federal prison system, so when we talk about these numbers, they are actually hard numbers, 5 years. He got out in 1995. He's been clean for, you know, so many years, and now is married and has a wife and two children and lives in Virginia. But he is in the computer industry, and there are a lot of jobs he can't do. I mean, when he first got out of prison, he wanted to become a realtor. He took all the exams in Virginia, passed the real estate exams, and they wouldn't license him. He petitioned the real estate board in Richmond, Virginia, and they said, nope, you're a felon. So there are so many barriers to reentry, and that's especially sad since we have something like 650,000 people coming out every year, we are going to need to figure out ways to allow them to reenter society.
What do you say, though, to those? And we only have about a minute or so left, and I understand it's a complicated question, that there really is no such thing as a victimless crime, that these drugs, they seem sort of harmless, and growing dope in his garage and all that's fine. That sounds like, you know, a movie. But that, you know, if you look at some of these communities who've absolutely been devastated by drugs, mm-hmm. people say there's no such thing. What do you say?
I think that the expression victimless crime means that someone is a willing buyer of the drug. I don't think that drugs, including alcohol and tobacco and coffee and caffeine, you know, are good for any of us. And so I think that we should all try to live as cleanly as we can. But I do think there's a big difference between two consenting adults engaged in an activity than there is, you know, someone literally jumping out of the bushes and attacking someone.
Do you think that the conversations that we are having around this issue have changed over the time that you've been working in this field? Do you see, I guess, one of more willingness to have conversations like this over time?
I do think so. No, I do think so. Congress has been my main focus for the last 17 years. And I think that everything ebbs and flows. Crime ebbs and flows. The interest in drugs ebbs and flows. This, too, will pass. But it's just a matter of time. And I think that the conversation is getting us close.
All right. Julie Stewart is president of Families Against Mandatory Minimums. She was kind enough to join me here in our studio in Washington. Julie Stewart, thanks again.
Thank you.